In April 2023, the United States was forced to evacuate our embassy in Khartoum, Sudan, as civil conflict consumed the nation. In this three-part series, you'll hear from a range of DSS personnel involved in the operation, giving you a first-hand look at how we enabled diplomats and American citizens to withdraw safely.
Welcome to After Action. I'm Chad Hammer. Today we bring you a very special episode with three of the key players from DSS who led the evacuation of Embassy Khartoum. We'll start with you, Ryan. Welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is Ryan Renouard. I'm a special agent with the Diplomatic Security Service and served as the regional security officer in Khartoum.
Hi, I'm Colin. I'm the security technical specialist in charge of technical security at Embassy Khartoum.
I'm Kelly Doffing, special agent, Diplomatic Security Service. I was one of the assistant regional security officers at Embassy Khartoum.
Awesome. Excellent. Welcome, team. So, set the scene for us a little bit. Obviously, this was a hasty evacuation, but didn't happen exactly overnight. What were you seeing in the week before the evacuation, let's say April 10th to 16th?
So Khartoum has been engaged in a series of negotiations where part of the political leadership from the civilians was attempting to negotiate a transitional government with the military that seized power back in October of 2021. As we started moving closer towards the 13th of April, the two opposing generals started maneuvering their forces in close proximity to each other, which caused us a sense of concern because an accidental discharge of a weapon or conflict in personality at a very low level could very easily spark a greater conflict in Sudan. So the Embassy Emergency Action Committee started looking at what are our key indicators that we really need to start changing our posture. What are the things that we need to do if we change our posture and how best to go about that?
So during that week before the evacuation, was it already on your minds that this might be necessary?
Yeah, I think so. In the past, there had been multiple instances where we were concerned that these two generals might start taking action against each other. And so we had a series of emergency action committee meetings leading up to that particular event. And one of the things that we did is we started looking at, do we need to restrict movements around in various different areas and how best to affect that change?
So at that time, you had people living all over the city, right?
So yeah, we had people living in 11 different locations around the city of Khartoum.
During regular operating business?
Yeah.
Right. So when we talk about that Saturday, you're actually referring to the 15th, right? A week before the airlift.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so something happened that day that facilitated or caused a lockdown, is that right?
Yes. So as the morning progressed, people were waking up 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, going about their normal business on Saturday. And we started receiving reports of gunfire from the embassy folks located about 10 kilometers southeast of the center portion of Khartoum. And that gave us a clue that this was not just celebratory gunfire. It was not just a random shooting and very quickly triggered our sense of alarm that this was an actual armed conflict that had begun.
Yeah, just after 9 o'clock in the morning, the Marines who were staffing the embassy contacted us to let us know that they were hearing what they described as crew-served weapons at a military base located in close proximity to the embassy. And then at that point, the Marines started their reaction procedures, and then we started rallying up.
So you had ways of reaching those people out in the community, right?
Yeah. We had found in some of the previous events that had happened in Khartoum that communications are unreliable. So we had multiple means of communications, which we tested repeatedly. We had radios, which we had just recently done a radio check with all personnel who were assigned to the embassy. Cell phones, mobile networks stayed up. So we were in constant communication with everybody who was stuck out during these events.
And Colin, what's going through your mind at this point? So as soon as the city kind of goes on lockdown, you start making preparations, right?
Very much so, because I was far away from the embassy. I was thinking, what's going to happen within the week? And I can't get there right away. And I know there's a lot waiting.
On the 16th or 15th, when you decide that the city should more or less lock down, you now have to start gathering people up. Is that right?
Yep. Consolidation became a huge priority for us. We were spread out initially in 10 separate locations, One of our 11 properties happened to be vacant at that point. So we started with personnel in 10 separate locations. On the morning of the 15th, two of our personnel who were closest to the embassy self-relocated to the embassy, including our detachment commander of the Marine Detachment and also our management officer, which took us down to 9 separate locations. But one of the first things you want to do is get full accountability. Where is everybody? Is everybody okay? And then from there, is everybody safe or safe enough? And what can we start doing to get people to a safer location? And what does that look like? Initially, we couldn't move really anybody. Things became very kinetic very quickly in multiple areas around the city. You saw active battles for critical terrain, critical features, any sort of military presence. The airport was an ongoing battle zone. Getting between east and west at that particular point in time was not feasible. So the initial decision was shelter in place, get inside, get to the interior away from the windows, get low to the ground, don't use the upper levels of your residence. At the time, our residences were getting hit by Dishka's machine gun fire. We were getting small arms fire. We started seeing mortar rounds impacting our residences. So exterior, or really outside of these residences, was extremely dangerous at the time. Even on our main residential compound, which houses about 80% of embassy personnel, we put into place a restriction of using armored vehicles to move interior to our own residential compound to get back and forth between our houses and the alternate command center where we were able to run operations.
So two things. I have to ask you to clarify. You didn't find that mortar rounds or machine gun rounds were intentionally targeting our houses, right?
No, we don't think we were being intentionally targeted, but Khartoum is a very condensed environment. We were seeing street-to-street battles being fought, and a lot of it was pure crossfire. Additionally, only one of the two combatants has air support. So any time that the armed forces would fly aircraft, the militia would attempt to shoot it down, and they would just be following the aircraft with their weapons, so you'd see stray rounds falling just out of the sky.
Ryan, what can you tell me about the events of the 17th?
The 17th is a very challenging day for us, I think, in Khartoum. We had had several days where we were attempting to try to figure out how best to go out and recover our personnel and bring them back to safer locations than they were previously located at. And we had had an aborted attempt the day prior where we were going to try to do a consolidation move. And because of the intensity of the gunfire and indirect fire coming down near both compounds, weren't able to do that. So we put together a plan using some armored vehicles. We had our close protection unit team. We had some other security professionals from some of our partner agencies that were there, and one of our assistant regional security officers all volunteered to go out and conduct a fairly risky move throughout war-torn city to recover some of our personnel. So the first recovery attempt that we made was to go to what we call our Charlie 9 or townhouses location. And that was approximately 2.5 to 3 kilometers west of the presidential villas where we had our alternate command center. So we went ahead and launched out this team. They were able to very quickly make that movement to the other location. The folks at the other end had been prepped and told to be waiting. And they were able to very quickly jump into an armored vehicle, pull into another motorcade, and then make their way back to the presidential villas compound where we were at the alternate command center.
So at that point, you weren't bringing anybody back to the embassy yet on that move. It was from the houses to the other compound.
Yeah, that's correct. We just didn't have a very good visibility on the routes from the presidential villas to the embassy itself. But we did have pretty good visibility from the location of Charlie 9 back to the presidential villas.
How many people were waiting at Charlie 9?
So that first move, there were 7 Americans that were located at that residence awaiting recovery.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they were ready to move with basically what they could carry?
Yep. The instruction that they were given is that they were to bring one small bag with their belongings in it And then there were some folks that thought that they may be sheltering at our location at the presidential villas longer and put some food in some of the coolers and brought some of that as well, which turned out to be pretty helpful. And so we're able to get over there no problem without any threat or mitigated the threat, pulled those people back and managed to bring those first seven back to the presidential villas.
But these people had moved to Khartoum to serve for multiple years, right? So there was household effects.
That's correct. All of our staff that were there had household effects in all of their residences. Even the people that were TDY there had more than just a small bag worth of belongings that were left behind.
But your heirlooms, your antiques, your family stuff, your art, your musical instruments, all that stuff is there with you, right, in many cases?
That's correct, yes.
Colin, you had your spouse there with you, right?
Yes, I did.
So what was that like for you having your own mission, of course, but also having family to worry about? And how was she handling the announcements and sort of the planning and this whole movement?
Well, we had talked about this before, about having go bags ready. And these go bags had the important documents, a little bit of clothing, and basically had extra room for anything else we had to put in there quickly. For example, photographs, art, things like that. However, there were two things involved with this. There was thinking of what has to be done at the embassy when I finally get the chance to go there, and how do I make certain that my wife stays out of harm's way because she didn't go to another high-threat post like Iraq like I did before, right. So she's not used to this.
Ryan, let me go back a little bit to the 17th. This was also the day of the incident with the motorcade, is that right?
It is, that's correct. So after we were able to successfully recover the first seven Americans, we reconstituted the motorcade and looked to make a movement to a residence that was about 3 miles south of the presidential villas. We had one member of another agency who was in a private residence that was there. And had an armed guard there, but the location was not necessarily in the greatest of places. So we really wanted to go and try to recover that person. Briefed the ambassador of the risk versus reward, and were given the approval to go ahead and make the attempt. Once we started the movement to go down there, and this was the same people that had done the previous move to the townhouses, they got to within about 400 to 500 meters from the residence that they are attempting to go recover somebody from, when the motorcade was attacked by armed men wearing what we believe to be Rapid Support Forces uniforms, using AK-47s, and of the five-vehicle motorcade, all of the vehicles sustained gunfire. One of the vehicles, being the fifth, went down on the ambush site. The motor stopped. The fifth vehicle containing my ARSO and two of the bodyguards were able to make the radio calls that they needed to do to obtain assistance from another vehicle in the motorcade. They were able to temporarily get the vehicle running again, managed to drive about another 100 or so yards away from the ambush site, and before the vehicle died. Another vehicle came back and were able to push them off of the ambush site for about 2 miles back to our residence. And the vehicle that was doing the pushing had four flat tires. The vehicle that was getting pushed, again, sustained rounds impacting the windshield and the passenger side glass right next to the ARSO's head. We were fortunate in that the tools provided to us by DEAV, our armored vehicle fleet managers out there, the vehicles held up to all the damage. None of the rounds penetrated the armor package. And frankly, the tactics that we are taught on how to react to an ambush by our team down at the Foreign Affairs Security Training Center, and some of the other training that our agents and bodyguards and other colleagues go through, really allowed us to be successful in getting out of that situation.
So counting those two movements, Kelly, and you'd mentioned at least one abortive attempt on the 16th, overall, how many movements are we talking about that require this coordination and planning and site reconnaissance and ambassador's approval? How many moves did you say you guys did in those 10 days?
Well, we had people at 9 different locations. Ultimately, we knew that everybody would need to get to the embassy. In total, we did around 15 different moves to make that happen. Some of the movements, for example, from the main residential compound required multiple moves because you can't get 40 people all at once. You had to go 4 or 5 separate trips to make that happen. We also had several other planned moves that we called off at the last second because security conditions were not permissive. The next day, we had another attempt planned to again go and get that person who was at that location and called it off because we couldn't make it happen at that point in time. What we ended up doing was a much more traditional type of move. We worked with our different security elements at post that we had from different agencies. We got as much support externally as we could. We did a lot to try and recon that route. We had a couple of our GSO drivers who went out and who drove a version of the route and successfully got to the hotel in an unarmored vehicle, which then gave us options. Because if we couldn't make it there in our motorcade, we already had personnel at that location in an unarmored vehicle, but it gave us some additional options.
The idea being that they were there in a, what appeared to be a personal vehicle, that'd be a lower profile. And
exactly. And they're both Sudanese. They blend in a little bit better. They can negotiate checkpoints. Because at that point, there were checkpoints throughout the capital, and you didn't know who was managing them. Yes, you saw RSF. Yes, you saw Sudanese Armed Forces. You also saw a lot of criminal gangs. There are some big organized criminal gangs in Khartoum, and you didn't really know coming up to a checkpoint who was in charge, what kind of command and control there was. So we ended up taking an armored vehicle convoy to make this move. Just for context, if you were driving from the embassy to this hotel and back, with the total lack of traffic that there were, that was the case at that point in time, it probably should have taken about 45 minutes. This move took over 3 hours. As they were driving, they had to negotiate some checkpoints. As they're driving, we're monitoring them as best we can from the embassy. And we start getting reports. We're getting followed. Okay, there's a technical vehicle behind us. So there's a pickup truck with a mounted machine gun pointed at us, and they're with us now. Okay, now they want us to stop. Then they negotiate that a little bit. Okay, we're going to go. Oh, nope, they get followed again. They ended up getting stopped and surrounded by 4 technicals, including one with anti-aircraft guns, surrounding them, and then having to negotiate their way out of that. That's another situation in which the local staff were absolutely critical. There was one local staff in particular who, in the midst of all of this, in what looks like an extremely serious situation in which we had major, major concerns for the safety of all of those personnel, got out of the armored vehicle package, walks straight up to the militia, and starts yelling at them, which is maybe not, you know, my first technique in negotiations, but the bravado and the confidence on that person, he literally yelled at them and said, "What are you doing? What are you going to do? You're going to shoot at us? You're going to kill me? You're going to waste a bullet on me in the middle of all of this? Go ahead." And then at that point, was able to start negotiating with them and talking with them, and got in touch with their local commander. The ambassador and DCM were both working through their contacts. We managed to get in touch with one of the local militia captains, and we were on the phone with him in Arabic, negotiating, "Hey, this is what we're trying to do. We don't have a stake in this particular conflict. All we're trying to do is go and get our people. We're trying to get to this location, pick up some people, get back. We want to get out of your hair."
And when did you make it to the embassy?
So everybody that was at the presidential villas where our alternate command center was located got there on the 20th. My plan had originally been to stay at the presidential villas with some of the security element to continue to try to recover the people from the Carinthia Hotel in the Northwest. I got a recommendation, let's just say, from some of the senior leadership back in Washington, D.C., that my place was much better served at the embassy. And so I traded spots in motorcades with Kelly, and she ended up being the last of the RSO staff at the presidential villas. And I moved on the 4th movement, I think, out of 5 to go back to the embassy.
But again, you had to navigate or orchestrate the bulk of this from not the embassy.
That's correct. Yeah, most of the work that we were doing was from the presidential villas in our alternate command center, which had some good capability there, but not nearly what you had afforded to you at the embassy.
Colin, I want to talk a little bit about your mission when you go back to the embassy. So you now, at some point, have orders to sanitize the embassy. Is that right?
Yes, very much so.
What was the scope of that? How many devices are we talking about?
There was quite a bit. The biggest issue was being away from it during all the chaos in the beginning. And the Marines had done some of the higher level destruction that had to be done. I went around to check on the equipment when I first got there to make certain that our security systems were operational, especially our video systems.
Right.
Because we have to know what's going on around us. Check in with Post One, see how the Marines are, see if there are any changes they've noticed, any technical gremlins that have popped up during my absence.
Post One is the sort of Marine command center, normally near the front door of the embassy itself.
Yes. And then basically make certain that my wife Sue was all set up in the TSO suite. And I said, you won't see me very much. I'm going to be very busy. And I was right. So then there was the check of all the areas where the high-level materials were. And there wasn't very much found after that. I was very happy about that. But as our main enemy, which was a military conflict, drove us out of our homes and drove us across the city, once we got to the embassy, I realized we had another enemy. And it was inside the enemy, and it was even more insidious, which is a massive amount of paper holdings that had to be destroyed. So that required a lot of creative activity with getting all the shredders lined up to where they were, getting them out of storage, all the supplies, keeping the destruction flow going in parallel. See it like being in a supermarket. If only one line is open, everyone's lined up behind that cashier. But the more cashiers available in the supermarket, the more you can do it in parallel. More people can get through it faster. That was the technique, and it worked. There were all these shredders all over the place. When they failed, I'd get them fixed, move on to the next one, check on people, see if they need something to drink, water that is, and basically kept going.
Right, so you have all the classified documents, classified hardware, cryptographic hardware, radio hardware, all that stuff has to be at the least zeroed, not destroyed, right? Made unusable.
Very much so.
Did you have time to finish it?
Well, it wasn't just me doing this. There are others involved, and I was checking in on them as well. I thought at first that we were getting hit by mortars on the top of the building because of the thumping sounds through the building of sledgehammers at work. And imagine sledgehammers hitting the concrete or something just above the concrete and going as close to the concrete as possible. And it's like, that's a good sound to hear now. I like that sound. And it kept going.
What other kind of equipment? You had additional weaponry and ammunition to get rid of, Kelly?
Sure. We got very lucky with one of our Marines. He turns out to be very skilled in the trades. So he's very hands-on, and we had him literally with like a sawzall chopping through equipment, which was much faster than the DS recommended ways to dispose of equipment.
So in these situations, you have now a lot of people living not where they had been living or staying temporarily in an effectively a fortified office building. Mm-hmm. So you have to worry about not only physical casualties, but also mental health casualties and life support. What did that look like for you?
It was a lot of proactive communication. It was humor, and it was trying to assess on an individual basis, where is this person? Where can I meet them? And how can we help get them into a position where they are okay enough for now until we can get them to real psychological support later? You know, people were pretty heavily traumatized as things are going on, and they know their residences are getting hit. You know, in some cases, they're hearing it or they're seeing it. Some people had to flee their houses to get to better houses where they stayed for a couple of days. Anytime we did a consolidation movement and we got people moved to a safer location, we celebrated it like it was the moon landing. Major celebration, because it was a really big deal. And we were very, very excited by it.
So Colin, same question to you. What were lessons learned or things you hadn't expected, things you wish you had known or would tell a colleague in this situation?
Always keep the future in mind. There were some people who I was communicating with during the town halls, and they were talking about holes in their windows, and they were concerned about the mosquitoes coming in. Not more bullets, but mosquitoes. So I said, well, once the shooting stops, this is how you're going to patch up the windows. We have duct tape. We have Ziploc bags you can put over some of the bigger things. Always give them a future because they have a future. And that helped pull them through. And it helped pull me through as well.
So talk me through, now you have everybody at the embassy. This is the 20th or the 21st, Ryan. When did you get the order or the guidance that the military was coming into effect this evacuation?
We had some inklings prior to everybody getting to the embassy. When I started talking earlier about how we were getting a timeline that was starting to tick down, I think that that information came on some other systems that we knew, okay, we need to effect this move and we need to start planning to do all of the things that we need to do to be able to leave should it come to that. And so as we got back to the embassy and were able to get on some of the other communication systems there, that gave us a little bit better fidelity on what our task was going to be over the next couple of days, what our timeline was going to be, and really what we needed to start on immediately to be able to affect all of the destruction of sensitive material at the embassy and get everybody ready to go.
So what did it look like? I mean, what did an airlift from a traditional embassy look like? You know, I'm used to an embassy that uses an airfield all the time.
Yeah, so because of the situation in Khartoum, there was not an airfield available for us to go out on a traditional airplane. So that leaves a couple of different options, all of them rotary wing, so a helicopter or a tilt rotor or something like that. And at this point, we just know that we would prefer to be somewhere else once we're done doing all the tasks at the embassy. And our colleagues at the Department of Defense are really good at planning and using the tools that they have available to effect a recovery. So we didn't really have much of a say in what we were going to be getting on. We just knew that, you know, they were going to come for us when we needed them to come for us. And so we continued all of our preparations at the embassy by completing all of our destruction of materials. And we were done at about 10 o'clock p.m. Khartoum time the night that we evacuated and had about another 2 hours after that before we actually got on helicopters. So you have to prepare all of the staff that are there that these are the space limitations. This is the weight that you can bring on a helicopter because, again, it's not like a passenger airliner where you can just load all your bags underneath. So they were restricted to a small backpack that you could carry, put in your lap. And so we went through several iterations of gathering people, putting them in the appropriate locations, checking bags, making sure that everybody knew what was going to happen and when. So we knew, they knew, the military knew where we needed to go and had a good plan in place to be able to move out there. So we have everybody out there staging in place. We're waiting. Okay, it's about time that we think that they're going to start coming.
And what time is this?
So this was, we originally thought we were going to leave around 11:30 p.m. local time, and it ended up being closer to 12:30, 12:45-ish in the morning.
So at some point, you had to bring down the flag, right?
That's correct.
What did that look like and when?
So we talked, myself and the debt commander, earlier on the day that we departed about a flag retiring ceremony. And there's not necessarily a procedure for that, but we knew we wanted it to be memorable. But we also didn't want it to be upsetting to a lot of the staff as well. So talking with the ambassador, we had the security teams that had been involved in going out to recovery people in town. And then we had the bodyguards that were a part of that move as well, and the RSO staff and the Marines. So we gathered about 8:30 that night to do the flag retirement ceremony. The Marines lined up in formation, very solemnly retired the colors, lowered them down, folded, presented the flag to the ambassador. He turned and handed the flag off to me for safekeeping. And then we quietly met with the teams that were all there for that ceremony, for a quick word from the ambassador expressing his appreciation for all the hard work that the security team had done to get everybody out safely. A couple of people had some tears. It was a very moving, emotional moment. And so that's how that went. And I think there are some pictures that were taken from that moment as well that have been released to be able to see.
So, Colin, this was a place you had invested a pretty significant amount of time, right? How long had you been in country?
I had been there almost 3.5 years.
What did it feel like for you then to leave under these circumstances?
Well, I used to say that the only way to get me out of this embassy is either PCS or to pry me out with a crowbar. It was just a little bit short of when I was supposed to leave. And I'd seen all the different cycles of instability before, starting with the January 2020 shootout with different battle zones in the city. But that was over quickly. The ferocity of this conflict was much greater than what I'd expected. We knew something bad was coming, but we didn't know what form it would take. And it was far above what we thought. So it was the right thing to leave. We were in good hands while we were there. We were in great hands there and when we were leaving as well. And we made it back to America. And I looked at my hands and said, I have all 10 fingers. And my wife said, I've got all 10 fingers too. And it's like, we made it out of there. And yeah, it's time to go.
How about you, Kelly? What were you thinking in those final hours and when you got back?
As soon as we got to the embassy, I started feeling better because I knew that we were behind ballistic reinforced steel and glass and concrete. So we were already in a much safer location. But the idea that, okay, we're leaving for real, we know it's happening, that was pretty exciting at that time. We knew that we were leaving behind most of a life. All of our possessions, all of our personal belongings, you know, you had what you could fit into one backpack, and not a huge oversized hiking backpack, but a reasonably sized backpack. Yeah, I was just thrilled that we were able to get all of our embassy personnel and families out. That was the best thing for me. Everybody made it out safely.
Well, team, I want to thank you all for being here. I can tell this is still very fresh, and I know these things last a while. It means a lot to me that you share this for the good of our teams and the good of our colleagues who might face us again in the future, and to help people understand what you went through and what sadly they may also go through. I really appreciate your time. Thank you, each of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
For having us.
Thank
we appreciate
you very
it.
Much.